You're about to listen to a BBC podcast, and maybe it's one I had a hand in. I'm Tammy Walker, and I produce podcasts for the BBC. My role is to give new and diverse creators a voice with the opportunity to build a career. That's the thing I love about podcasts. You start with just a good idea, but then you have the space to see where it goes. And doing that at the BBC means we can really run with the best stories while developing the most unique audio talent. So if you like what you hear, why not check out the huge range of podcasts we've got on BBC Sounds?
Thank you for downloading this programme. In this edition of The Bottom Line, Evan Davis and guests discuss how companies charge for the price of time.
Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, the tyranny of the timesheet is our topic. I don't know how many of you work for an organisation where you bill by the hour, but it is the default method of charging for many services, from plumbers to consultants. That's why there can be gags like the one that has a management consultant dying at the young age of 40 and arriving at the gates of heaven. St. Peter, he says, why has my life been taken from me so early? Ah, St. Peter says, looking at the billable hours on your timesheet, we thought you were 92. Ha ha ha. Billing by the hour has a certain simplicity, but it also has lots of flaws, and it raises the question of how you charge for labour in a modern service economy. It was easy to price widgets. There's a price per widget, but in most jobs these days we're not producing such simple or measurable things. So what basis do you use? What we'll do today is canter through some different ways of pricing a job and talk to those challenging the conventions of their industry. And with me to do that, and this sounds like the beginning of a joke, I have an estate agent, an advertiser and a lawyer, and let's meet them one by one. First of all, Russell Quirk, founder of online estate agent eMove. And Russell, this is an online agent now, but you have a background in traditional estate agency.
Yes, I do indeed. So I ran for 10 years five estate agency branch offices in Essex, and as did my father before me and his father before him.
Right. So yes. The traditional way of pricing the transaction in an estate agency is, most people will know it, but just take us through it.
You pay at the end of the transaction based on actually this property having been sold, and therefore a no sale, no fee basis is how the industry term it.
It's a commission.
Yes, yes.
And it's typically...
In London, it's about 2%. UK-wide, it's about 1.6%, plus, of course, VAT. And that's based on the ultimate sale price of the property.
And your model, which is a little different, so take us through that.
Yeah, it's quite a bit different, really. So we charge at the beginning instead of the end, and we charge a much smaller amount. So typically at eMove, our cost is about £400 plus VAT, depending on which extras you incorporate. It's substantially cheaper.
But you are the kind of Ryanair EasyJet model, aren't you? Because you don't get quite as much as you would with the full service estate agent.
I would disagree with that. We do everything that a local estate agent would do in terms of coming out and taking the photographs, providing a floor plan, organising the viewing, scheduling and so on. At the moment, we don't hold hands with the viewer in terms of showing them around the property.
You don't keep the set of keys. It's the buyer, it's the seller who has to do all
that. But we've actually found that the buyer certainly much prefers the owner of the property showing them around, because, dare I say, there's an element of perhaps greater honesty on the part of the seller rather than the agent showing them around. We're a disruptor. We're disrupting the industry.
How old is your business?
The current business is nearly 5 years old. We're doubling in size every year. So yeah, we're our direction of travel is looking pretty promising, I have to say. Okay.
Well, we've been going a couple of minutes. We've already been introduced to two different ways of charging. One is the commission. One is the flat fee. Let's talk to Debbie Klein now, who's the UK Chief Executive of the Engine Group. Maybe just tell us what Engine Group does, Debbie.
So we're the UK's largest independent communications group, doing a variety of things from advertising, social media, public relations, sponsorship, data analytics.
And you came up through WCRS, which was a major advertising agency with some big successes against its name, such as...
Sky Believe in Better and the Churchill advertising, the Santander advertising. Very populist work that people will be familiar with and have seen on TV. Mm. But now 60% of our revenue now comes from digital channels in one form or another.
Right. Now, what's the default way in your business of charging for your services?
Going back about 80 years, the advertising industry used to charge commission on media money spent. So you got a percentage of the money that clients spent on TV or radio or press. The assumption being that the more you spent, the more effective the campaign was going to be. That changed about 20 years ago and moved to an hours-based. So effectively a fixed rate per hour or per day for an individual, working out how many hours a task is likely to take. So labour-based, cost-based, no relationship between between the price paid and the value generated by those ideas.
My goodness, you're really in a business where the product of an hour's labour is so heterogeneous. I mean, just so different, aren't they?
Yes, and I mean, you know, over the years, examples in our history where the value created by the ideas that we've come up with, you know, probably the most famous one being 20 years ago when we launched the Orange brand.
The future's bright, the future's orange.
The future's bright, the future's orange created £3 billion of shareholder value for that company, not on its own, but as part of an overall marketing mix. And we got paid the hours that it took to come up with and execute.
I'm sure your hours are very generously paid, though, Debbie.
Having said that, we obviously got new business off the back of that and many creative and effectiveness awards, but there was a huge disconnect between the value generated. That's an age-old example, but a famous one.
We'll come back to trying to link the value of the output and the hours. All right, so we've had commissions, we've had flat fees, we've had hours. Let me introduce my third guest, Christopher Saul, senior partner at the law firm Slaughter and May. Slaughter and May, for those who don't know it, Chris, it's a magic circle firm,
yes.
Which means...
The magic circle is an informal name that attaches the five leading law firms that are headquartered in London.
Your sorts of clients, these are big corporates, basically, for
Absolutely.
Takeovers, mergers, tax issues, the whole works.
Absolutely. So examples would be Marks & Spencer, Mothercare, GE of America, Mass Transit Railway in Hong Kong, and various governmental departments. So we do a lot for government as well.
The default payment system in law.
The default payment system in law is probably still the chargeable hour, and comes back to your timesheet thing, that I think the bane of a lot of young lawyers' lives is the timesheet. And there's an interesting history to that, because when I joined the firm in 1977, so I'm quite old, it was not that way. You know, we did record time, but the real system of billing was seven pillars of wisdom, as we called it. So complexity, novelty, size of deal, and to some extent, time. And what happened really in the 90s was that the concept of the chargeable hour travelled across the Atlantic from the States to London for all the reasons that you can imagine. It's sort of easy to understand. You can audit it, all of that. So in our world, somewhat different for our firm, but in our world, the chargeable hour is the default mechanism for charging.
And how difficult is it to keep a timesheet for a good lawyer? Because I've heard really quite horrendous descriptions of what life is like. Is it literally every 10 minutes they have to kind of write something down or ping a little iPad?
It is. I mean, you're somewhat a slave to it in reality. So some, often the older generation, prefer having a piece of paper, writing down 10 minutes talking to Evan. Others prefer smart time, as they're called. So you can click on and off on your screen. So 10 minutes talking to Evan on the screen. But it's quite a... you know, quite a discipline to get used to that.
Just tell me, Chris, how many hours is everybody expected to clock up? Are they don't have to fill their whole day with billable hours.
They don't. Typically, you know, lawyers will actually clock, if you like, somewhere between 1,500, 1,800, maybe 2,000 hours per year. And one of the, I think, refreshing things about our firm is that we have no billable hour targets. Our notion is that to give people targets for billable hours sort of promotes the incentive to inefficiencies.
Isn't there a transparency issue with the hourly rate? I mean, how does the consumer know what you're actually doing and what you're billing? I mean, for all the consumer knows, whether it's law, accountancy, you tell me you've done 10 hours worth of work, how do I know you haven't actually done 8?
Well, clients ask for that, actually. So an increasing trend, and it's understandable, it's exactly your point. They say, please show me your time entries because I want to know who's been doing what. And I want to have the chance to deduplicate, for example, if I think, you know, that Chris talking to Evan for 10 minutes is actually too much and really that should have been 8 minutes, I have some way of auditing that.
It puts the risk on the buyer, doesn't it? When you take a job on, Chris, it's quite hard to know exactly how many hours it's going to be.
Correct. So some lawyers would say, and some clients would say, we worry that this is open-ended. It could kind of take a lot of hours. In which case, of course, they will get into a number of sort of diversionary and constraining tactics. So they may say, number one, tell me every month how many hours you've done so I can actually see where this train is headed. Number two, you often talk about caps. So you will say you will charge at an hourly rate, but we need to agree a formal or informal cap. So the way the world has evolved, in fact, is a sort of rather more textured way of applying the hourly rate.
With many professions, though, isn't there also the added complication with the hourly charging dynamic, whereby there's a seniority difference as well? Yeah. So often my lawyers say, well, look, if you want to talk to a senior partner, it's £500 an hour. But if you like, I can throw in a junior and he's only £250 an hour. That actually adds a much more complicated variable, I think.
Absolutely, you're right. And that does complicate things. But you will still know at the end of a month, for example, what the running total is.
My last two interactions with lawyers, actually, very recently, I managed to do a deal with them, actually, where it was on a fixed fee basis. And I have to say that gave me much more comfort,
sure,
that I knew what the outcome was going to be. Obviously, they had to deliver, and I knew in advance what it was going to cost. So it made sense to me.
One of the problems, I know this, because several people in the professional services have mentioned it, is the business of trying to get work where you're not able to charge for the hours of pitching, but actually the pitching is itself incredibly expensive. Now, in your business, Debbie, that is a really big piece of time. Often you've actually done half the work before the meter has been turned on for billable hours, hasn't it?
Yeah, so for the most part, we have to pitch for new mandates from clients. We might then win a retained piece of business for years and years, but generally clients don't walk in the door and hand it to us. We do have to pitch in the competitive market. You don't get paid to pitch, so you have to invest that up front. So you have to take a view on effectively the probability of you winning that business.
How much work goes into a pitch, though?
It could be up to £100,000 worth of hours. You know, a lot of money, a lot of hours, a lot of people, often on weekends and late nights. So you have to really believe you can win it. And that is our world. It is not actually getting better, it's getting worse. There are more pitches, and you have to go all the way to the end and show the ideas and the campaign and exactly what you would do. Very often that isn't then.
And indeed, give it all away.
And
give away your secrets to the
client. Well, we will show them an idea for a campaign, an idea, executions, but we own the rights to those until the client pays us for them. Just because we've shown it doesn't mean that they own it. We own it.
Right. Okay. Now, one aspect of this which is important is, what is the relationship between the billable hour and the individual employee's remuneration? Now, how does this work in your company, Chris? I work for you. I bill up so many hours. I'm charged out at a high rate. I don't get anything like that much individually, do I?
No. And in our firm, it has no connection. So our trainees are young lawyers, and then they become associates, and they are paid a salary, and that salary increases as they become more senior. Every year they will also receive a bonus, so we pay bonuses. But the critical point is that bonus is not attached to the time spent. So in some environments you may say, to achieve your bonus this year, Snooks, you must bill 1750 hours. And to some extent, that's creating a slightly awkward incentive in our view. So the bonus is driven really by the overall performance of the lawyers in our organisation. There is no specific link to the hours that they spend.
But in other law firms?
In other law firms, it is, I believe, the case that to qualify for your bonus, you will need to hit a certain strike rate of hours per year.
What about in a state agency, Russell? Commissions, individual agents get a piece of the commission, don't they?
Yes, they do. I mean, in traditional estate agencies, that's the case. In mine, we actually pay on customer service. But traditionally, so the mainstream estate agency business, the individual within that branch will be paid a percentage of the fee earned. Typically, it will be something around 10% of the agency fee, which, of course, is something between 1.5% and 2%. So a relatively small amount, I guess.
But what if you have four people in an estate agency who are all doing a little bit of work on selling a property?
Yeah, I guess there's an element of unfairness. I think actually the greater issue is this misconception, in my view, that having an estate agent that earns a fee at the end that's performance-based means that you're going to get a better price for your home. Because actually, in reality, if you work the numbers backwards, for every £10,000 that agent may or may not get you, the agency is going to earn £150, let's say, as their 1.5%. You then extrapolate that to what the individual earns, and he's the guy on the phone or girl on the phone doing the work in terms of trying to get the deal over the line. It ends up being about £15. So actually, in reality, and this was my experience when I ran traditional estate agency businesses, was that the individual just wanted to get the deal done at any cost. They didn't really care about the £5,000 or the £10,000.
That would be my perception.
And that's the, I don't know if you've read the book for economics, there's a very interesting chapter in there which talks about the US real estate market, where actually they found that the typical real estate agent selling their own home got a proportionally better price because, of course, it was in their interest to do so. But when they were selling somebody else's home, they cared far less.
Let's just go then to the commission model, because this is the traditional estate agent model. And Russell, take us through what's good and what's bad about that old estate agent model.
Yeah, the good point, I suppose, I think there probably is only one, is that you do only pay as the successful seller. So if you put your property on the market and it goes through, you're happy, big inverted commas, to pay because obviously you've seen an element of success. The huge downside, of course, is that an agent will go out, and actually using the pitching analogy, will go out perhaps four times just to win the business once or twice. The property then comes onto the market. Obviously, the client hasn't paid any money. They may have a change of mind, or indeed right at the last knockings, and Chris will know this, I guess, as a lawyer, if he's got any conveyancing history and experience, is that you can get literally to the day of exchange of contracts, and either the buyer or seller decide to pull out. So it actually works out that about 25% of what the estate agent does in terms of their hours, if you like, actually comes to fruition in terms of a fee. But what that actually means is that the successful seller clearly subsidises the unsuccessful ones. So Mr. and Mrs. Smith decide to mess around and not ultimately go through with the sale for whatever reason, get off scot-free, and Mr. and Mrs. Jones that go through the whole process, get towards the end, have to pay a big lumpy fee because that fee has to subsidise the 75%. And the other element, of course, is with property is that there's a price percentage relationship as well. So if you're selling a £100,000 property in Bradford or you're selling a £1 million flat in London, you will pay a tenfold difference to the estate agent.
So it's accidental, really, that.
But this is the key. Look, how much harder is it? This is the key question. How much harder is it to sell an expensive house than a cheap one?
Let's be honest. I mean, up until recently, obviously, the London market's cooled off a little over recent months. But the work that goes into selling a prime central London property, even £5 million during 2014, was far easier than selling a £150,000 three-bedroom property in Middlesbrough. So actually, as the market, the market's got easier and easier. It's easy to sell a property.
Really,
the hours come down in terms of how long it takes, but the agent gets richer and richer because he's spending less time. And of course, his fee is linked to property prices, which has increased. It's absurd.
Let me just remind everyone, we're talking about how you charge for a job. And with me are Russell Quirk of the online estate agency eMove, Debbie Klein of the Engine Group, Advertising and Communications, and Chris Saul of the lawyers Slaughter and May. Now, one of the first requirements of a good payment system, as I understand it with a bit of economics background, is it should align the incentives of the seller and the buyer. Hourly rates, they just don't do that. I, as the seller, just want to clock up as many hours as I possibly can. Debbie, do they in your office, do they just dawdle, take longer over things than they need to?
Definitely not. I mean, it's not the case that it is usually an uncapped hourly. It takes as long as it takes and we'll charge you for every hour. But the conversation is moving much more towards actually what is the value that you're creating. And we're starting to actually look at what we're doing. Our activities fall into broadly kind of three sort of areas. The first is the work that we are doing for clients, which is the day-to-day work, you know, things which oil the wheels of the business, but they don't value as highly as other things. So it might be writing a line of code for a website. And then we're doing slightly more upstream work where we are helping them with their strategy, coming up with a thought for their brand, which might actually help to drive that business in a different way or reach a different target audience. And that's more valuable. And then in the third area, we're coming up with business transforming ideas, brand ideas, some of them we've discussed, which can actually drive shareholder value, increase the value of the company. And the work that it takes and the time that it takes to do those, we don't believe we should be paid according to the hours, but rather the value that we're creating.
Well, we've got onto this issue. The really key thing is that the problem in all the businesses you're in is that actually it's quite difficult to measure precisely the value of what you do, isn't it?
Well, I'd say in our industry, it's easier than it's ever been because of digital media. So we're undergoing the biggest period of technological and consumer behaviour change in the history of our industry. So you have this enormous speed of digital feedback and data that tells you how things are doing.
You haven't told us how you measure it. The model you would like is to say, hey guys, we produced this brilliant advertising campaign. The future's bright, the future's orange. It has generated this much value in terms of sales or for your market capitalization as a client. And we should be paid something in relation to the value we produce. But I can't tell how much your campaign has added to that and how much it's the general macroeconomic condition, which has been improving potentially, or the quality of their service. There's so many things that go into the success of a company. To actually pinpoint what you've delivered as opposed to what they've delivered is surely very difficult.
So over the years, we've got better and better econometric models that do that, which measure both the tangible effects, so market share, but also things like attitude towards brands, so positive impact. If you think of the Sainsbury's Try Something New Today campaign, well documented how much that generated for them as a retailer. In fact, I read a fascinating point that the value that it created for Sainsbury's was worth more than 35 years of fees that it paid the agency. So we can now measure those facts, isolate those impacts. I'm quite sure you do this in your business,
Russell. I was going to say, Debbie, you're absolutely right. And what we find in our business, which is a digital business, it's now acutely and instantly measurable. We ran a TV campaign in the summer. We could instantly see, literally minute to minute, what those TV adverts were doing to the traffic on our site. Slightly harder to track resulting transactions as such, but we could absolutely see the impact it was having in terms of people coming to our website.
I don't think it's a case of completely binning the hours-based model. There is a place for the hours-based model for some of the work that we do. But I think you need a menu of pricing options. So one of them might be, for example, fixed price based on perceived value. So fixed price based on perceived value would be one. Variable pricing based on the outcomes. So I will be paid on per car sold, £10 per car sold, or pricing based on usage. So if we're coming up with an idea for a client, which is a software idea, we actually own the IP, the intellectual property. So I think it's a more nuanced and sophisticated model rather than that sort of blunt instrument where there's a role for each of those, right. But it recognises these enormous seismic shifts in the digital world.
What about in law, Chris?
You make a good point, Evan, when you say, actually, if you're value billing, how do you assess that value? So when you get to the billing stage with your client, you will say, look, we believe that our value add is very significant. And the critical thing, I think this is the important point, is a lot of what governs the landing and the understanding of the value you've had is the, you know, the real friendship often that you have with your client.
And if you're in a long-term relationship, it's possible to negotiate an outcome on the basis of this for this job, knowing that you know what sort of value each person expects.
Exactly right. And also, you will say to, you know, to this client, here's this other not so exciting thing, which we will do for a modest fixed fee, because this is part of something that is very precious to us. And that is our relationship.
Debbie, your suggestion really is a much more complicated pricing structure, different elements of hours and output, the value of the output and the complexity of the work. It does take you back to where law used to be.
We had sort of come full circle.
Yeah. How difficult is it to move from a convention in an industry that you price by the hour or by a commission to get from there to a different structure? You're really trying to disrupt it, aren't you, Russell?
Yeah.
But you can sort of see that people may say, I just don't know. I'm probably not going to get as much value if I do it differently. And so there's a sort of an inertia, isn't there?
Yeah, there's definitely a resistance for sure. And particularly in our industry where the bulk of the industry, 95% as it is, they still charge the same way as my grandfather did in the 1950s. So to sort of change that culture, yes, it's very, very difficult. I guess it's a herd mentality, isn't it? Once you get to a particular tipping point, you know, you get past that point in, what's it called, the law of diminishing innovation, isn't it? Once you get to the point where it starts to become mainstream, people start to accept that this is real and I can trust it. But you're right, there's obstacles.
There are also sort of structural developments, actually, because as the hourly rate sort of grew and there was more competition in our world, the procurement departments of big corporations who procure all sorts of things begin to procure legal services.
Oh, yeah. Now, this is absolutely key. We should mention these. These are departments that have came from nowhere, really, to be some of the most important people in corporate
absolutely.
Life.
So the procurement department is a vital oily rag, right. process.
People who may not know what they do, they're responsible for buying everything that the company buys.
Exactly right. So everything from heating oil to legal services sometimes these days. And this has been a big growth thing over recent years. And so we need things that we can measure readily, and we need things that are auditable, and we need something that we can compare. So Chris costs X, Debbie costs Y, you know, that sort of thing. So the procurement infrastructure that we find in our world has tended to embed, I think, the hourly rate.
I think often clients want to be able to compare services, so it's easier for them to compare an hourly rate so they can standardise the products and they can say that's what we're getting for that much money versus with that other service over there or that other different type of consultant that we're using. We do have to deal with procurement departments, and there's, you know, at the very extreme, the rise of something called the e-auction, where you go onto an electronic system and you put your price in to deliver that particular scope of work. And then you bid, you know, in real time against your competitors. And literally the phrase race to the bottom, you see it in real time.
But not for advertising itself.
Indeed, for the hours.
Is price the only caveat, the only requirement?
No, that is not the only. They will take into account, of course, the creative product. And it's at the moment a minority of people who are using it. But we don't believe that you can buy ideas, strategies, creative thinking, PR advice in the same way that you buy electricity and widgets. So in principle, will not take part in those.
Yes, that sounds remarkable, but that people would actually procure your services on that basis.
And then you do see e-auctions for legal jobs. And how does that work? Well, you have a spec and you have assumptions and you bid off that and you have an hour live in a room. It's really scary, actually. You know.
So it's difficult to move from A to B. But Debbie, if you go to a client and say, look, we don't want to just bill you by the hour, we want something a bit more complicated, what do they say to you?
For the most part, clients are really willing to explore new arrangements where you're prepared to take a bit of risk. We want to be in this with you. If you succeed, we'll succeed. You know, we're just at the beginning of this journey.
You had one example, 118118. Tell us about that.
118118 was an example of a launch that we did 10 years ago now, which, of course, was the new directory inquiries market. And we launched the now famous runners. And that was probably one of the first times that we did have an appetite from the client, even back then, for performance-related pay. So we had a target for market share, and we exceeded that by multiple times because of the success of the campaign. And it was actually an uncapped bonus arrangement. So we did well out of that then. But, you know, all too often, that is very much the one example that I can choose over the last period. And there aren't enough of those. You know, the business that invented the Meerkat campaign, if they got a pound for every cuddly toy that was sold, I don't know if they do, you know, then they'd probably be doing very well.
Great.
Mm. How often do clients grumble about their bill? Well, how many do you get, Chris?
Very few. And why is that? And I think that's because clients quite rightly don't like surprises. So we try absolutely to avoid surprises. At the end of the day, we don't send a bill until we've discussed it with the client first. So that's essential to the relationship.
Ah.
So, you know, we will never say, dear X, 79 guineas. That doesn't happen. So you ring up and you say, Evan, I was thinking of X. Okay by you?
And how often do you have to compromise, Chris?
Sometimes, absolutely. You know, because, you know, if they say, it'd be very helpful because the CEO is very concerned about costs this month, could you do X? Of course we will do that. So the essence of our approach really is to nurture the relationship because that's the heart of our business. So we don't send bills that clients are going to be surprised by or don't want to pay.
Well, this is the absolute heart of it. Just at the As we get to the end of the programme, we learn that there's this big thing called the fudge factor, which gets applied right at the end, before the bill is sent. Forget all these 10-minute slots they've been keeping assiduous records of.
I'm just happy to be in a room with a sort of a compromising, nice lawyer. So, I never thought I'd see the day.
All right, well, we must leave it there. Let me thank my guests, whose services have been provided free of charge. Russell Quirk of the online estate agency eMove, Debbie Klein of the Advertising and Communications Group, The Engine Group, and Christopher Saul of Slaughter and May. Visit our website, bbc.co.uk/bottomline, for details of how to download the programme. Otherwise, I'll be back with more guests next week.
That was Evan Davis. The producer was Rosamund Jones. The Bottom Line is produced in association with The Open University. And if you enjoyed this programme, you can download others via the Radio 4 website.